Welcome to Shanahan on Literacy, the site where we believe there is nothing more noble than to teach somebody to read. I'm Tim Shanahan, your host, and today we're going to talk about how can effective teaching do harm? Yeah, that's a puzzling one, isn't it? Let's get right into this. On May 14th, 2022, just about 4 years ago, I published what I thought would be my last word on reading recovery. This was a blog entry published on the Shanahan on Literacy website. Well, turns out, fat chance that it's going to be my last word on it. Reading Recovery, if you don't know, is a remedial reading program aimed at first graders. It started in the 1970s in New Zealand and was widely adopted throughout the United States. Over the years, it has been both widely lauded and decried by reading authorities. From its inception, it was the focus of lots of research, much of which seemed to support its effectiveness, though I expressed concerns about this, both in a review of research in 1987 and another one in 1995, as had others at the time. Iverson and Tunmer published a critical study of it in 1992, for example. The combination of its one-on-one instruction and its extensive teacher development requirements make it an especially expensive intervention. In 2022, Henry May and his colleagues at the University of Delaware reported a fascinating study, extensive and high in quality. It was a follow-up to an earlier study they had conducted evaluating the effectiveness of reading recovery. That earlier study found clear learning advantages for the children enrolled in the program. The study, first reported in 2022 and published in 2024, evaluated the long-term benefits for the program when kids were in third and fourth grade, and the results weren't pretty. Reading recovery advocates claim that its students would become self-improving systems, no longer with a need for remedial support, a promise meant to allay the concerns about its high costs. But according to the May study, these kids needed as much or more of those additional services as the untreated population. Evidently, there was no saving at all, just additional expenses. Even worse, the reading recovery kids did less well in reading by grades 3 and 4. Their achievement levels were lower than those of the comparison kids. In other words, reading recovery hadn't improved their ability to keep learning. If anything, it appeared that it had somehow made them less able to keep up with their classmates, and that's really the reason why people are raising questions. That was what I wrote about in that blog that I thought would be my last word on reading recovery. Well, however, in the past few weeks, I've received multiple queries about the May study. Each was as skeptical as I had been about the possibility that reading recovery somehow disadvantaged these children. By the end of grade 1, the reading recovery kids were outperforming the reading of similar kids who hadn't had the advantages of reading recovery instruction. How could that be a problem? Some emails question the quality of the study. For example, as is often true with longitudinal research, attrition levels were high. Large, potentially biasing losses of subjects can undermine the trustworthiness of a study. In this case, well, there were still 15,000 kids in the study. This is a big study. And the various analyses showed the unlikelihood that attrition had affected the results. The results seem screwy. I've never seen this kind of long-term negative result from any instruction. But there was nothing screwy about the study. One questioner raised the best query of all, in my opinion. Something very weird is going on when first graders who got a lot of one-on-one help from an expert teacher end up going backwards. What's your theory? I didn't have a theory. I had taken the study to mean that reading recovery didn't have the lasting power its advocates claimed and treated the underperformance as a kind of a quirky anomaly. But what if it weren't? What if reading recovery made it harder for kids to keep learning well? One explanation for that would be, you know, this one is particularly popular with reading recovery opponents, is that intensively teaching students an approach to reading that is inconsistent with how we actually read, you know, 3Q-ing, may have long-term negative consequences. That may be, but one could level the same kind of argument at some phonics instruction. Let's face it, we don't read by sounding out words laboriously, and studies do show that kids who come to expect too much regularity or consistency in our orthography don't do as well as those who recognize English orthography as a more complex and conditional system. The benefit of phonics is that it guides kids to pay attention to spelling patterns and alters their memory in ways that makes it possible for words to be easily remembered. Any youngster who perseverates on the sounding out part or who rigidly expects letters always to be related to certain phonemes wouldn't be likely to make the same gains as kids who have a better purchase on the nuances of our spelling system. I doubt that either 3Q-ing or sounding out usually have those negative consequences. Kids wisely don't follow what we adults say that slavishly. But what about a child who's working one-on-one with an adult for 30 minutes a day for 12 weeks? That might be somewhat a more persuasive circumstance. Perhaps with that kind of intense instruction, more kids might be persuaded to approach words through context rather than through the spelling. I've never been a big fan of this explanation, but it would be unreasonable to dismiss it out of hand. Another possible explanation is that kids identified for inclusion in reading recovery may differ in some unidentified qualitative way from those kids who are ever so slightly higher performing in reading. That could mean that reading recovery hadn't really done any harm in the long run, just that the kids it serves are in especially great need, which makes it hard for them to keep up. Of course, that would also mean that reading recovery is not a sufficiently effective program for those lowest performing children, which is a serious problem since those are the kids it targets. In 1995, I pointed out that reading problems have two possible sources: something internal to the child, organic or neurological differences, or something external to the child, environmental problems, including poor teaching. It was evident to me at the time that reading recovery was increasing students' ability to read, but that it wasn't altering either students' ability to learn nor the kids' environment. If youngsters had perceptual problems or an especially weak memory, they'd still suffer those ills, even though they would have slightly higher reading scores. Likewise, if mom and dad weren't encouraging academic success at home, reading recovery wasn't altering that either. Those parents would continue to not be very supportive. Despite the claims of reading recovery advocates, there was no reason to believe the program would make kids successful in learning to read from then on, you know, that one-and-done kind of idea. But that wouldn't explain why they would do even worse than comparable kids who didn't get the treatment. That's why it would be necessary to posit some unidentified factor that makes those lowest dozen kids different from everyone else. Whatever that unknown difference might be, internal or external, it should be obvious from the May study that reading recovery was insufficient to adequately address it. That would argue against the heavy concentration of resources demanded by reading recovery, since students with such stubborn learning problems should be expected to need ongoing instructional support. Currently, we rarely plan for that kind of continuous need. Interventions usually aren't designed to provide multi-year support, so our lowest progress kids tend to end up with a patchwork of programs, much of the teaching repetitious, and all of it poorly coordinated. Personally, I think this is the most likely of my explanations. Nevertheless, this, like the others, is a hunch, not a research finding. A third possibility for the odd results reported in the May et al. Study could be that the degree of support offered by reading recovery is so extensive that it ultimately undermines kids' confidence, leading to learned helplessness and its consequences. These kids know they're getting a substantial amount of help. 60 or more half-hour lessons delivered one-on-one is substantial. That so much help fails to alter their course. Despite reading recovery, they still require additional remedial assistance. That could be especially discouraging. It's easy to imagine students concluding from their lack of success from so much help, "I must be really dumb." That explanation highlights something important about any remedial teaching. It's essential that we set specific goals for remediation, goals shared with the students, goals that we're serious about accomplishing. That way, kids will have very specific ideas of the potential value of what they're being provided, and they'll be aware of any real learning gains that they make. What we shouldn't do is make the kinds of claims offered by reading recovery advocates, that the students' reading problems will be extinguished once and for all. Likewise, I'm wary of any program that touts learning guarantees. In medicine, it's considered unethical to promise cancer cures, and I think we should be equally cautious when it comes to assuring learning gains. Those are my three conjectures about why a program like Reading Recovery might appear to slow student learning in the long run. First, it may have slowed student learning by inculcating bad reading habits. Second, it may only look like it interfered with learning because it failed to address the real needs some students have. Or third, it may somehow have undermined student confidence, making them more likely to withdraw or quit trying as they move forward. I don't know if any of these explanations holds water, but thinking about them suggests some important insights about remedial instruction that I've shared here. In any event, kids enrolled in Reading Recovery did less well in the long run than similar kids who didn't receive the program. No matter the reason, those sad results recommend caution. If I were calling the shots in a school district again, I'd discontinue the program until and unless I received a satisfactory explanation, and my three hypotheses aren't sufficient for that. That, I hope, will be my last word on Reading Recovery. It certainly will be my last word on it today. If you'd like to get a written copy of this, go to the Shanahan on Literacy website, and you'll find a blog that posted on March 28th, 2026, How Can Effective Teaching Do Harm? One of the benefits of getting the written version of this, besides the ease with which you can share it with your friends, is that you get to see the research references, and in this podcast, there are five of those, so that might be useful. With that, I'd like to thank our sound engineer, Greg Johnson, and I'd like to thank you for tuning in. I hope to see you up the road a piece.